Welcome, everybody, to the F-Ball NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Hengst, AFC North lead writer at Bleacher Report and Pro Football Focus fantasy football contributor. I'm joined this week, like every week, by my co-host, Brian.
Heyo.
How's it going, Brian?
It's going. You know, it's we have to apologize for missing last week. It was quite a week of things going on last week, and even more this week. We'll be catching up on all that here. But we have to apologize. We had some renovations to make in the green room, the profiterole chaise. You know, it was starting to turn.
Well, we now have an entire living room set. Like I told our esteemed guest, Rumford Johnny, yesterday, we have now a full living room set made of profiteroles. So a lot has happened since the last time we were here at the F-Ball Podcast, and so I figured that the best way to go about discussing all of these things was just to do it chronologically from the first thing that has happened to up to today's latest news. So
that sounds very
sensible. I think that's pretty good. So we're going to start with, 2 weekends ago, it was announced that Missouri defensive end, outside linebacker Michael Sam is indeed gay. Apparently one of the worst kept secrets among the scouting community. Everybody kind of got wind of it during the Senior Bowl, and so they wanted to get out ahead of the story and kind of control, not have Sam be outed by somebody, but
right.
Somebody else, but have him be able to do it on his own terms.
That's smart.
I would say that a lot of the response that I've seen has been mostly positive. You know, I think that, there were a lot of coaches who, spoke to the media directly afterwards, directly addressing the Michael Sam thing and saying, I have no problem and we have no problem as an organization drafting a gay player and that it doesn't make any difference in the locker room. But then you had a lot of anonymous, scouts and things like that speaking to reporters, specifically Sports Illustrated's Peter King, saying that it's never going to work and that players won't accept him. But those anonymous cowards don't really – I don't think that they really echo the sentiments of the NFL. There was a poll taken of the players, and 86% say that they wouldn't have a problem with a gay teammate. While it's a little unnerving that there are 14% of players out there who are homophobic, I feel like those numbers pretty much line up with American society anyway.
Openly homophobic.
Openly homophobic. And I would say there's 14% at least of the American population are openly homophobic. So
sure, at least.
At least. So.
No, I don't think anybody has a problem. Everybody's quick to say that they don't have a problem with it. But it'll be interesting to see who does it. It's like, they cannot have a problem with it, and they can say they don't have a problem with it, but like, I think a lot of people are going to be afraid to be the ones to take him.
Yeah, but I think honestly, as we've kind of gotten away from the initial wave of media reaction to all of this, that the real question about Michael Sam is not his sexuality and how his hypothetical future NFL locker room is going to handle it. It's, where's he going to be drafted and by whom? Because he's one of those tweener defensive end, outside linebacker types. Personally, I think that the demand for a player of that profile, I think, is increasing for most teams around the league. Fewer and fewer teams, I think, you can look at and say, they play 4-3 base defense. They play 3-4 base defense. I mean, you get these hybrid looks from defenses that, maybe even 5 years ago, you could be like, yeah, they were paying like 85% of their snaps out of their base defense. And now, there are teams who are in the nickel for their base defense and things like that. And you have guys who were franchise tagged like Terrell Suggs years ago as in between the defensive end and outside linebacker because of the way that they used him and lined him up. So I actually think that there's a future for Michael Sam. It's just trying to figure out, when are we going to draft this guy? Because he could end, I mean, he's co-defensive player of the year in the SEC, and that's nothing to scoff at.
Sure.
And you don't, but with a tweener type like him, you don't want to take him too high because you could potentially get him later because scouts are still kind of dubious about this kind of position and get a value,
Well, and that's kind of where I'm going with this, though. I think that you're right on in that evaluation as far as that, the straight up football wise, where does he fit and where should he go and all that. And I'm saying, like, in, even beyond that, I think that there are going to be some teams that are hesitant because of the gay issue, that they're going to, you know, they're because they, like I said, they might not have a problem with it, but maybe they're afraid to pull the trigger on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, because there's going to be a level of media scrutiny, at least for the first couple of weeks, if not, you know, heading into training camp, about, oh my, you know, they don't want to have this media distraction where all of a sudden every time the coach is speaking to the media, all they ask about is Michael Sam, when he's just like, well, we drafted these other guys and we have this new free agent or whatever. So I can understand that. I mean, that was a concern with Manti Te'o last year,
and that's,
you know?
And that's the cop-out answer, you know what I mean? It's just, well, we don't like the media attention, so we're going to pass.
Well, yeah, but then you have teams like, when you talk about, like, Manti Te'o, and, the San Diego Chargers were well-equipped to take on a guy like him because they're not a team that the media is, like, latching on to anyway, and they have a very controlled environment. You know, I think there's, you know, some teams that you know, are... won't mind, like, regardless of the media attention. They like him as a player who cares. You know, I think that there are going to be some sort of, you know, a subset of older school style GMs and owners who don't want a gay player in that locker room. And I think there are also going to be some GMs who have absolutely no problem with a gay player in their locker room or head coaches or whatever, but know that maybe the nature of that particular locker room would
it
be welcoming to him, you know?
Right.
But you know, I think it's just really great. I think that he is going to be drafted. I think it'd be really shocking if he went undrafted. I mean, you know, I mean weirder things have happened. I mean, you look at Vontaze Burfict, and you know, he's kind of a wild card as a player, but you know, he's turned into, you know, one of the greatest linebackers playing in the NFL right now, greatest young linebackers in the league, and yet, you know, he went undrafted and, you know, has displayed the fact that yes, he was absolutely a first round talent in 2012. It's just that these other concerns.
Well, he always had the talent, and but his concerns were straight up, you know, is this guy stable,
right,
in the head? And you know, I don't think it's certainly not that kind of question.
No,
you know, but. No, I think it would be surprising if he didn't get drafted, and that's the thing, is that somebody should, and I'm assuming somebody will, go there and actually, you know, take that step, draft the kid, put him on the team, and deal with whatever media scrutiny ensues.
Yeah, because you own your draft pick, because you just own your draft pick, and who cares?
And the kid will work out to be good or not, and we'll see.
Right.
And but it's still important, just because.
Well, this is a milestone, you know, with the NFL. I mean, we've had players come out after they've retired, but we haven't had anybody who was openly gay and playing and active
right.
in the NFL.
And it's one of those things where it's like, if we see it's okay, then it, you know, it'll be okay for other people.
Yeah,
I mean
if this experience,
it's dumb that it's got to be like that. But.
Right. It's dumb that it has to be like that, but yeah, if the entire process of Michael Sam from coming out to being drafted, to how his teammates, you know, react to him, how what the media attention is like, you know, does he take the field? What does he look like in his rookie season? All of these things, you know, if it's all looking positively, then that's a good first step for other players to feel more comfortable coming out about their sexuality.
I think regardless if he ends up on
because
a team
there's more gay men in the NFL or in college football than just Michael Sam.
Absolutely, it's and yeah, we'll see, you know, how comfortable people get and how quickly that happens.
I'm happy. I mean, I'm just glad that this happened. I'm glad it finally happened.
I think it's only
good for Michael Sam and for the NFL.
Yeah,
really.
And I think he's gonna turn out to be fine as long as he doesn't end up on a team with Richie Incognito.
Yeah, I have a feeling no one's going to end up on a team with Richie Incognito. That guy's... There's going to be a muzzle in his new contract. We will get to Richie Incognito and Jonathan Martin in a few minutes.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to jump ahead there.
Our next story, because we're going again chronologically, is yet another Cleveland Browns moment. So after firing Rob Chudzinski, the former head coach who was on the job for less than 12 calendar months, they spent about a month on their coaching search, as we've discussed in episodes past. hired Mike Pettine, the former Buffalo Bills defensive coordinator. They rounded out their staff. Kyle Shanahan came on as the offensive coordinator. Jim O'Neill, who was the linebackers coach with Pettine in Buffalo, as the defensive coordinator. Getting all that ironed out. And then last week, last Tuesday to be precise, Browns owner Jimmy Haslam announced that general manager Michael Lombardi and CEO Joe Banner's jobs in Cleveland are done. And that Ray Farmer, the assistant GM who turned down the GM job with the Miami Dolphins for unrelated reasons, reasons that are pretty obvious why you turn that job down. So he's the new general manager. Now, a lot has, you know, there's been some revelations coming out in the days after the move. Obviously, it looks like Banner, Lombardi, and Haslam really clashed over the coaching search. Banner and Lombardi were having issues at each other during the coaching search. Joe Banner really wanted to wait until after the Super Bowl and get a chance to interview Seahawks defensive coordinator Dan Quinn. And Jimmy Haslam just said no. You know, this is my ultimately, this is my team. I own it. I want Mike Pettine. He's the head coach. And then there were some ideas that Banner thought that Lombardi would be out, but that he'd keep his job. But then Haslam just said, "Let's get these guys and out of here. It's not what I wanted. I stepped away from the team. I come back. We're losing. I need to have more control. You know, Ray Farmer is going to be reporting directly to Jimmy Haslam. Things like that." You know, I understand Jimmy Haslam's frustration, you know, and but at you know, one point I think to myself, I don't even know if this would have come about if they had just gave Chudzinski one more year, because I mean, it seems like the real fissures that happened in the top decision-making faction here in Cleveland, you know, came because of this coaching search. And it just doesn't look good. Like, why do you fire your head coach?
Potentially it was just exacerbated.
Yeah,
by the coaching
potentially, search. But it's crazy to me that you fire your head coach, you hire another one a month later, then a week before the scouting combine begins, you get rid of the guys who are getting you prepared for the upcoming draft and free agency periods in Joe Banner and Mike Lombardi. You know, it just seems like if you were frustrated with them or you wanted them out as an owner, you would have done that sooner. Why didn't you just clean the entire house? When you fired Chudzinski.
It didn't go there until after the coaching search.
Apparently not. And you know, I wrote an article highly critical of Haslam. And I you know, I have no problem with Ray Farmer as general manager of the Browns. He's gotten a lot of respect around the league. You know, he's kind of a career scout. It's going to be interesting to see how he can handle the draft, but everybody seems to be very confident in him. The Browns have new head coaches all the time. Mike Pettine has kind of a different disposition. I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. I have nothing against him. My problem with Haslam is just the methods. Of now you do this. This is how you want to, you know, run this franchise. You look stupid. You know, and you know, he said in the press conference announcing all this, he said he underestimated what it took to be an owner and, you know, described that it was a very steep learning curve.
That doesn't help.
That actually makes him look worse. You know, if he's learned from these mistakes, from what he believes is the mistake of hiring Lombardi and Banner, if he's learned from it, and this doesn't happen this way again, then good, okay? Great. Good job, Jimmy Haslam. You've learned. But at the same time, this also looks like he's extraordinarily impatient, you know? And it smacks of like, oh, I'm a billionaire who loves football. I can absolutely buy a football team.
I have a theory.
Okay.
And I can say a theory like this because I'm just a co-host on this podcast. I'm not otherwise associated with any sort of media outlets.
Yes.
I tend to think that this is a lot of this, at least, is on Haslam here. And he put everybody in place 16 months ago. And it's his team after he cleaned house the first time. With people that were doing okay, I thought, when it was not that, you know, the
well, they were able to stockpile draft picks for this year. Things seem to be set up, you know.
That's the thing is things were happening and you're building something, right?
Yeah, so you're building.
You put people in charge and you're building something. And originally he was all Mr. Hands Off. He's got these people in place and they're going to do this thing. They're going to build this thing. And it's the fact that he got rid of Banner and Lombardi so quickly shows that he's impatient, because those types of moves you don't make that quickly. Nobody ever does. And so that shows that he's impatient, which makes me think that impatience is, you know, more widespread than that. And therefore, he started the thing in motion 16 months ago. He got impatient
right.
with what was going on. He got impatient with the coach. I feel like potentially he pushed to get the coach fired when they were just kind of like, you know.
I mean, yeah. I mean, the defense collapsed in the second half of the season. They went through three quarterbacks, and they didn't have a run game. What do you expect? Do you expect to win more than four games in that situation?
So you didn't even give them a chance, basically.
Right.
And so I feel like he maybe was pushing to get Chudzinski out, and result of that was having this coaching search happen,
right?
Which, like, so then at that point, if they weren't really all seeing eye to eye on whether they should have got rid of Chudzinski, and he was just like, get rid of this guy, and they got rid of him, and you know, then it moves into this coaching search, and
right.
nobody can agree on where the thing should go, and it's just the whole thing just reeks of him just not knowing how to build this long term thing here. And it's just, it's got to be instant gratification for him.
Exactly. And here's the weird...
That's just a theory.
Here's one of the weird developments, too, of all this, is that, you know, part of this whole coaching search timeline was, you know, they went after Josh McDaniels, the Patriots offensive coordinator, and then he pulled himself out of the running. And then some point, 24 hours after that, either he wanted to get back in or the Browns wanted him to get back in, depending on what the source was, and he got back into the coaching search. And then ultimately they decided not to go with McDaniels, probably because Jimmy Haslam was already fed up with Lombardi and Banner, and Lombardi particularly. And, you know, Lombardi kind of handpicked McDaniels, and he was like, no, I don't want any of these people, you know? I just find that interesting. It just seems like they couldn't figure out what they wanted in a head coach. They couldn't figure out who to talk to and when to make the decisions. And, you know, Jimmy Haslam, you know, he's a billionaire, and he's earned that money, even though, you know, he might be under federal indictment sometime soon. He's under investigation. But, you know, he's earned that money, and so obviously he knows what it takes to run a business, but an NFL team is a different sort of business.
Right. I'll tell you what.
If you run a corporation and you put a CEO in charge and they lose a ton of money in the first year, totally fire that guy. But if you have taken on, you know, a financially unsound, I'm not saying the Browns are financially unsound, but they lose, okay? So they lose a lot. Like, you expect to turn that around in 1 year? I mean, it's different than turning the Chiefs around after
right.
1 year, because the Chiefs haven't lost every, you know, had a below 500 record every year except for one, you know?
They had a decent team in place and then had a bunch of injuries, which led to their incredibly poor season. And so they bring in the new coach, and it's a lot easier to turn that back around.
You can
around,
bounce back
obviously.
From that, but when you're yeah. mired in it, you know, and you have so much coaching turnover.
The culture of losing. We right. talked about it with Mike Freeman before the season, I think.
Yeah.
And it's that culture, or maybe it was during the season. It's that culture of losing, though, and it's turning an aircraft carrier around.
Yeah,
I mean?
And I mean,
it's not a tugboat.
And the established veterans on this Browns roster, I mean, this is, you know, some of them, they're fourth coaching staff, fifth for some of the older guys, maybe fifth, fourth
yeah.
at least.
Continuity can help sometimes.
Continuity can help. and you know, I understand the desire to not stick with something that's not working. But considering the circumstances of the Browns' 2013 season, how could any team make that work?
Exactly. So,
how could any team start three quarterbacks, have no run game, and have a defense that collapsed in the second half of the season and win games? How do you do that?
Right.
Chudzinski, Bill Belichick, who can do it? No one.
Well, I'll say this.
So I just question Haslam's decision making and judgment.
I'll say this: if something happens legally with Haslam here, with the whole pilot.
Oh, he can hand it off to a family member. No big deal.
Well, I'm just saying, if somehow he ends up not in charge of the team, I bet there's a book that comes out, and then we'll get the whole story at that point.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, the Browns haven't been a very tell-all organization. It's kind of had to been gleaned from sources.
The people you would talk to aren't
sources,
there anymore.
Sources. Yeah. I mean, Michael Lombardi, I mean, he's already back with the Patriots. He's a personnel assistant or a a special
maybe
advisor.
About 2 years
or something.
From now, maybe you should look into writing that book.
No one's gonna talk to me. You kidding? No one talks to anybody.
You might be able to get
banners
here.
I'm concerned about what kind of NFL owner Jimmy Haslam is. If he's learned from this experience and things get better, great. That's what should happen. But if he just continues to be, you know, kind of not just impatient, but you know, impulsive almost.
Impulsive and overbearing.
Then that's going to be trouble. Then there's going to be more coaching turnover in Cleveland, guaranteed.
Yep.
And that's the last thing that they need. So
yep.
Hopefully that can get fixed.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back to talk about a couple more serious, even more serious things that have happened in the past week and a half or so. So we'll be right back here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast.
Stick around. If you wanna be real, then you got to reveal the truth. If you wanna be real, then you got to reveal the truth.
We're back here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast, and we're recapping the many major events that have happened in the NFL in the past 2 weeks since we've last been on the air. We just talked about Michael Sam and, of course, the Cleveland Browns situation with Michael Lombardi, Joe Banner, Ray Farmer, and Jimmy Haslam. And now, as last week wore on, we got to the end of the week, and the Ted Wells report on the culture of the Miami Dolphins locker room, and specifically what went on between Richie Incognito and Jonathan Martin, was released. It's about 140 pages long. I read through all of it. I read some of it twice. It was very upsetting. You know, somebody who's been bullied before. It's very upsetting. Ted Wells did find that Richie Incognito systematically bullied, harassed, harangued, emotionally assaulted Jonathan Martin, who comes from a very different background than Richie Incognito, and from, you know, many, very different background from a lot of NFL players. You know, and he was targeted by a guy who's been known in the league as being, you know, king of the a-holes, basically. It wore Jonathan Martin so down so much that, you know, he contemplated suicide a couple of times, and he ultimately just said, you know what, sometimes you just have to walk away from a situation that's completely unhealthy for you. In the aftermath of the report, obviously there are some people still in denial about Richie Incognito's behavior and what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate in an NFL locker room. Because, yes, NFL locker rooms are different workplaces than anything else. And it's a weird brotherhood, and there's weird hierarchies, and there's weird language and weird jokes and all this kind of stuff. Sure, I think anybody in the NFL will acknowledge that, former or current player. But locker rooms like this, a locker room environment, an experience like this that Jonathan Martin had, it is not common around the NFL. And you had players coming out in defense of their locker rooms and of an intern of Jonathan Martin by saying, that's not how we do it in any part of our locker room, nor would we ever tolerate anybody doing anything like this to any of our players, ever, full stop. So Richie Incognito flipped out a little bit. Went on some Twitter rants because is he hinged? No, he's unhinged. He later apologized and said he got to get his mind right, probably because his agent told him that, no, you're never going to play for the Dolphins ever again, but if you can just shut up and be contrite, maybe another team will give you a one-year deal and see if you can have another shot at the NFL. Because right now, it looks like Jonathan Martin has a better chance of being in the NFL, even though, of course, yes, there are a lot of players who are like, oh, he broke some stupid code. Screw your code, all right? No one should protect some stupid code if you're being treated like this. Why?
It's absurd.
It's absurd.
I mean, the main point here is yes, there's a culture in NFL locker rooms, and no, that's not going to change. And honestly, I don't necessarily think it should, as far as, you know, general camaraderie amongst guys.
Yeah, and there's a level of hierarchy there that exists, you know, and obviously rookies don't have the same standing as a long-term veteran.
But that's the whole point there. It's one thing to have, you know, have fun with guys, and that's what everybody is trying to say, is like we enjoy each other and have a good time.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's razzing that goes on and stuff like that. But the main
terrible language and bad jokes and whatever, sure.
This isn't, I don't think this is necessarily a condemnation on NFL locker rooms as much as Richie Incognito.
And the culture that he created in a Miami Dolphins locker room that had no accountability and no leadership. You know, there's a line coach. He participated and encouraged this behavior. The head trainer, he participated in and encouraged this behavior. They've both since been fired. You know, head coach Philbin, he had a complete turd, we'll say, of a press conference today at the scouting combine in Indianapolis. You know, he just kept preaching about accountability, and I can't believe I didn't know about this, and I can't believe he didn't know about this either. If you want to have accountability and leadership in the locker room, while in the same breath saying you had no idea.
If I
would have known, I would have stopped immediately. To me, that's insane.
Yeah, I don't know.
He should be more involved with his team in the locker room.
You would think, but at the same time, he can't be everywhere at all times.
No,
but he should have his
finger on the pulse of his team.
The thing is, the thing that I think most implicates him as being at least an enabler here is there was discussion about him telling Richie Incognito to, or someone, that they were aware of some sort of, like, they wanted him to bring him along.
Right.
You know what I mean? And they should have known that, or they knew who Jonathan Martin was and what his personality was like.
Sure.
And they knew who Richie Incognito was.
Oh, yeah.
They knew what his personality
was.
His
reputation
was like.
So precedes him.
So, like, it almost seems like intentional. That they
were like, this guy can toughen him up.
Not right. Not necessarily that they thought that he was going to, you know, berate him or harass him to the point where he couldn't take it anymore and it would be a bad thing. They thought of it as a good thing, which potentially is, you know, it's like more of an old school fix, you know, rub dirt on it kind of thing.
Right.
And an old school ideal, just, you know, get on him, ride him, toughen him up, and all this, and
right. But you have to forget.
Is,
you
if
forget
nothing
then.
Else, just if nothing else, it's just a poor choice by the coach.
Right. But then you and it also forgets the fact that, like, these guys aren't just little NFL stereotypes. You know, these are like people. Jonathan Martin came from a very affluent upbringing. He went to Stanford. He was kind of sheltered from the guys like Richie Incognito, and it worked for him. And it worked for him at Stanford. And, you know, he just was not. He was not ready for Richie Incognito, and Richie Incognito pounced, and nobody intervened.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You have to be able to keep these guys away from each other in that situation. You're setting up Jonathan Martin to become Richie Incognito's prey. And no, there doesn't need to be a predator-prey mentality within a team's own locker room.
I mean, basically,
that's, like, ridiculous to me.
I guess,
it on the field against your opponents, man. My main
thoughts about Philbin are that I don't know that he was necessarily implicit here as much as negligent. You know, he would say
he was definitely negligent.
Complicit in the fact that he potentially directed this to happen for him to.
There's been little evidence of that.
There's been little evidence of that. So there's rumors or
it
whatever.
It might have been the O-line coach that was to blame for all of that.
Well, and that's the thing.
And he's gone.
He's closer to that situation, so obviously he saw it up close and personal. He was probably more than anybody responsible for
he participated in it.
The direction of not only participating, but saying, Richie, I want you to toughen this guy up,
right?
You know, ride him, get on him, and turn him into a man. That kind of thing. You know what I mean? But I'm sure that Philbin was aware of that situation. But, like, just not all over the details of it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And so that's what I'm saying. I don't necessarily think that he should have known more or anything like that. I think he should have known more. I think it was just it was just poor decisions on his part and not it's negligent. He chose to not pay attention or he didn't know his players well enough, which either of which is pretty reprehensible.
Yeah, you're a head coach in the NFL. Exactly. You're not like a middle manager at a shoe corporation. I don't know. Whatever. My point is,
he should know his players well enough to know that wasn't a good idea.
Yeah. And then moving on to something else that was also negative that happened after this happened over the weekend. Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice is alleged to have gotten into an altercation at a nightclub / casino in Atlantic City with his fiance.
Well, he's not. That's proven, right? That he actually got into an altercation.
No, I mean that's the chart. That's on the police report. Those are still allegations.
Oh.
They're both alleged to have gotten into a physical altercation with one another in public at this nightclub, and the ultimate result was Ray Rice one punch knocking out his fiance,
allegedly,
dragging her into an elevator, and then trying to drag her unconscious body out of the elevator.
Not
no, that's on video. Personally, you know, Deadspin, when they got wind of these charges against Ray Rice, they did a little Twitter sleuthing and they noticed that there were people who were at that nightclub that night tweeting about that night, about watching Ray Rice knock out his fiance. Now, this is just, it's disgusting. I'm very zero tolerance, and I understand that there are salary cap implications. The salary cap is going to be $130 million this year, surprisingly. Everybody thought it was going to be $123.6 million. So that frees up some cap room to get rid of Ray Rice, should they so choose. But I'm very zero tolerance with crap like this. You know, I'm prone to believe it just because of the eyewitness accounts and the video from the elevator. But of course, the court of law will ultimately determine Ray Rice's guilt or innocence, and I understand that. I understand that I have inherent biases when it comes to reports of anybody harming any woman in any way ever, because it's not cool. All right, but if Ray Rice knocked out his fiance in public, regardless of how much they were drinking or what they were doing or why they were arguing, there's no excuse. Worse things happen behind closed doors. If you can hit your fiance in public, you do much worse when no one's looking.
Well, let me put it this way.
That's domestic violence rule 101 right there.
Regardless of rule 101, because, and I'll say this, that, you know, even though we're still alleged,
yes,
on all of this stuff.
Allegedly
talking about all this.
No, we're talking about alleged things. We're not allegedly talking.
I'm allegedly talking about this. to go there as far as he probably, you know, if he does this in public, what does he do at home?
That's a fair assumption, though.
I know it's absolutely a fair assumption. I'm just saying that we don't even know, you know, if it's proven that he's done this at this point, because it's a legend,
right?
To go there on other stuff, I don't think that even it warrants discussion. Right.
Well, no,
now
it just kind of grosses me out.
The point is, if he did this, it doesn't even matter what he would do at home. I mean, obviously it does, you know, for her, you know, and all this. I'm just saying, like, that in and of itself, It's so absurd to even consider someone doing something like that, public or in private, wherever.
And think it was okay.
It's such a horrific act.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Yes. It's just ridiculous. And to say that, and like I said, I don't even want to speculate on what might happen at home. This is, we're talking about this one issue here. And if it's true that he did this, and it really looks like he did, I mean, one of the first things I was thinking is, is there something wrong with him, like, mentally? You know, because we've seen this a lot lately with these players, and, you know, is it just that, you know, they play a barbaric sport and they're, you know, they can't, you know, they have a hard time controlling themselves? Or is this something deeper and there's rampant, you know?
I don't think it's something deeper because there's never
mental health problems.
I don't think there's something deeper because he's never been arrested before. He's never caused a lot of problems. I mean,
he
did spit in Joe Thomas's face earlier this season, and he did have a bad year because he was injured, because the O-line sucked. because he gained 10 pounds and it took away from his speed. But I'm not going to make football excuses for this behavior. I'm not going to.
And that's my point, because this is such a horrific act.
It's I'm not making football excuses for this.
It's not even like he was clean and he got into a fight or something like that. It's like he knocked the chick out, and it's his fiance.
Yeah, so I'm not putting football reasons on this. I'm not gonna if we're not gonna speculate about what happens behind closed doors between Ray Rice and his fiance, then I'm not gonna sit here and speculate about CTE. That's bull.
But I'm not necessarily saying CTE. I'm just saying mental health issues in general.
Sure, maybe.
But there hasn't been, he certainly hasn't had any sort of track record like this. But it also could just been a thing that was well concealed. I don't know.
That's quite possible. I mean,
but
people abuse people and conceal
at the end of the day,
the
there's no excuse for this. No. I mean, nothing makes this, you know, better for him.
I think that the Ravens should cut him, because here's why.
I don't think he should play in the NFL.
He
should go to jail.
If he's guilty of this, if he gets found guilty, he should go to jail. But
I think
that the Ravens should cut him. If they determine that this event happened in the way that it's alleged to have happened, then I think they should cut him. Because here's the thing, now there's surprise extra cap space. That restructure Joe Flacco already. Make some room. Who cares? He's a running back. You can find another one. He's not the most important guy on your team by a long shot. You know, you're not gonna harm your team more by cutting him than you are gonna be by keeping an abusive dude, you know, and excusing his behavior. But that's the double standard of the NFL. You know, if this was somebody on their practice squad, like, or somebody with a reserve futures contract, for example, they would cut him.
He'd be gone in a second.
He'd be gone in a second before there is a trial or a hearing or anything.
It's a financial impact on the business. So.
Sure, and that's why when these allegations came out years ago about Ben Roethlisberger and sexual assault, he's too important for the Steelers to cut. You know, and he was ultimately with the thing in Georgia, not charged. So I guess that means he didn't do anything. But we're not going to go there. But my point, I just have a zero tolerance with this, because why are you coddling an abusive person just because he has a cap charge against your team that's a little high, or because he's your starter at XYZ position? You know, that doesn't excuse it. You know, if you're working at a corporation, and you're at a high level in that corporation, and you know, big on the day-to-day operations go through you or whatever, but then you get arrested for not cold cocking your fiance in public, you're fired. You're fired.
Yeah.
So
basically, you're fired.
That's what should be done with Ray Rice if he did this.
It's tough to say what you would do if you owned a team, because you don't own a team.
I know what I would do if I owned a team. You're not a billionaire. Well, that's why I can't run an NFL team, because I'm zero tolerance about this stuff.
But at the same time, even though it's tough to say that, I have to say that I can't imagine that I would want him on my team.
And, you know, the Ravens pride themselves about their high character, you know, of their players, mm-hmm. and how strong the vetting process is especially by GM Ozzie Newsome, and how, you know, they find these quality players and they have these guys, and you know, you can point to the Ray Lewis like murder investigation as one blip on that otherwise, you know, some sort of flawless record. But you know, I mean, if they want to take that reputation of theirs seriously, then they need to do something. And you know, I mean, they could still suspend him, or the league could suspend him, depending on, you know, what the findings are in this case, what the ruling is. So, I mean, there's still the option that Ray Rice might miss 4 or 8 or the entire upcoming season, depending
on
what's the ruling here.
That's another good point, is that even let's say whoever's tweeting this stuff was making it up about him knocking her out, and she just got really hammered and passed out. Well, he's dragging her. It's not alleged. It's proven at this point, because the lawyer admitted it,
mm-hmm.
that he was dragging her on video down
out of the elevator
and down. That alone, I'd say, is enough for Roger Goodell to say that, you know, that's not behavior becoming of an NFL player,
right? But
and,
you know,
and he could potentially.
But no, honestly,
I think that
the punishment should come down, because either the league punishes or the team punishes. There can't be both, and I think that the Ravens. should make an example out of Ray Rice by getting out in front of this and punishing him with a suspension of whatever length before the league does, so at least they can save a little bit of face and say, nope, this isn't cool. Because if they just stand by and they're just like, we're going to let the league decide if this is cool. Well, how about, why don't you understand that somebody punching their fiance in the face is never cool, even if he's your starting running back? Yeah. How about that? But that's the NFL for you. I mean, yeah, that's the double standard of the NFL.
I don't even know what else to say about this. I mean, it's just, it's a despicable thing to do.
Yes, and I know innocent until proven guilty, but there's compelling evidence here, you know?
I mean, technically Aaron Hernandez is innocent right now, right?
Yeah, technically, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we
have preponderance of evidence.
Well, that's only in a civil case.
No, I know. I'm just saying that
the preponderance of the evidence means 50% or 51%.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's most likely.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen in criminal cases. I know it has to beyond.
I'm just saying that there's a preponderance of evidence.
Yeah, mostly
as of right now.
Mostly circumstantial, which is the problem.
I know. I'm not saying you can convict on it. I'm just saying it's there, and it really seems like that's what happened.
Right. No, I'm with you. We're going to take another quick break because we just had our little block of negative stuff, and then we're going to jump back into something positive and then head on out of here for the week. So we'll be right back here on the F-Ball NFL podcast.
All right.
Is it clear in the mirror when you look at your exterior, inferior, interior voice? Some who don't want a good game, it came proper and offered at the junkies as a choice. Seems to whisper the sisters, the source they missed us, simply to get their financial support.
And we have returned here to the F-Ball NFL podcast, and we're just going to talk a little bit about the NFL Scouting Combine, which starts today, which is Thursday. You know, we've got the O and D lines showing up today to get weighed and measured, and their drills will begin tomorrow. Coaches and GMs are taking the podium today and tomorrow and often throughout the event to discuss very candidly their calculated media information that they're letting out about their draft plans and their free agency plans and things like that. Obviously, one of the biggest pieces of interest right now about the scouting combine is Johnny Manziel and how tall he'll end up being. I saw reports, I think it was Chris Burke from Sports Illustrated, who said that there is at least one team's contingent at the combine who have placed over-under bets amongst themselves on Johnny Football's height. I think he's going to come in at 6 foot even. I think he's going to really hope that for some reason he'll show up as 6'1", but I think he's going to be 6 feet tall.
No.
Not worried. You think he's going to come in at 5'11"?
5'11 and a quarter.
5'11 and a quarter. We're already over-undering here. This is so stupid.
That's my number.
So stupid. But it has got me thinking a little bit about the combine. You know, you just think about guys who are going to show up and guys who are not going to show up and who's going to really help their draft stock.
Who's going to throw and who's not going to throw.
And then there's also the sort of meta discussion about the combine, which is how important is it really?
Right.
I say it's not terribly important in the long run. I think there are certain positions, wide receiver, cornerback, where you want to see what these guys' 40 times are. You want to have them in controlled, you know, drills where they're backpedaling and then running and back, you know, and things like that. You want to know a guy's hand size. You want to know an O-lineman's arm length. These things are very necessary. You got power blocking, you know, O-line. You've got, you know, outside zone, and those guys have different, physical requirements in terms of size, speed, height, things like that. These things can be further illuminated on in the scouting combine. But by and large, I mean, what matters is the tape.
Yeah.
That's what matters. What matters is the tape. What matters is what they did at the Shrine Game or the Senior Bowl. Those are the things, you know, and the interview process, of course, that happens at the combine is always good just so you can get
I think the combine is pretty important. I think the drills aren't so much, and I think the interviews are really
like the long jumping,
the broad jumps,
why though?
there's things that you can see, and I think that similar to the the All-Star games, the bowl games, Senior Bowl and Shrine games and all that. I think this sort of these sort of platforms can do a lot for small school players.
Yes,
you know, you put them all on the same field and
See if they can
how
hang,
they measure
then it's,
up. You know, no pun intended or anything. But
I think that's a pun we made last year when talking about the combine.
Potentially, I don't know. I'm not going back to listen. And but I really think that what the teams can take away more than anything is for the interviews, and it's a chance to sit down and talk to these guys and ask their questions and just get a feel for the player. And because, you know, you see the tape and you can see what they can do, but half the time it's the guy behind the face mask, you know what I mean? What who is that guy and what makes him tick?
Yeah, is Jadeveon Clowney really going to just give up after he gets paid?
Right.
And things like that.
As
and
some
ludicrous
have,
questions like that.
As some people have speculated. And not that you'll know for sure after an interview like or anything like
and
that.
And you can go more in depth when you have your player visits, you know, later in the spring.
I bet some teams are a lot better than others than judging guys just from these interviews and their discussions and things like that. And some people probably do pretty well as far as understanding who might work well on their team and who wouldn't, you know. And that's where I think the combine is probably most valuable.
Yeah. But we
can't enjoy any of that.
No, but at this point now, we can only just talk about the combine and not what happens at the combine.
You know, guys run around.
The Spandex Olympics.
Sure, you know.
You know, but obviously there's nothing you and I can really say about the combine at the moment because right now, you know, all that's happened today is some press conferences and guys are getting weighed and measured. So obviously
we can't make a prediction on how fast we think Rich Eisen will run.
A little bit faster than he did last year. They're having cheerleaders run this year too.
I'm setting the over-under on him at 5.9.
All right. So we'll talk more about the combine in depth next week. We'll talk about, you know, whose stocks seem to be helped and who's got hurt by what happened at the combine. So stay tuned for that here at the F-Ball Podcast next week.
Sure.
And that wraps us up for this week here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast. So before we go, as is customary, it is time to read from the Book of Bradshaw. Otherwise known as It's Only a Game, the memoir by Terry Bradshaw.
Yes.
Without further ado.
Lay it on us.
The hits that hurt the most were the ones I didn't expect when I got blindsided. Those hits even hurt me when I was watching them on the films 2 days later. But truthfully, when one of my people missed a block and I just got buried because of it, I did tend to take advantage. In the huddle, the player who missed the block was devastated. Oh man, TB, I'm so sorry. That just is never going to happen again. I swear on my mommy. You all right? You okay? I definitely should have been nominated for an Academy Award for my performance inside the huddle. It's okay. Just give me a minute. Wait, now, there it is. The feeling's coming back now in my legs. No, I'm fine, really. I didn't need all those fingers anyway. Is my nose still attached to my face? Ah, the brutality of being the man
Terry.
Under center. So with that wraps up this week's episode of the F-Ball NFL Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Andrea Hengst. I am the AFC North lead writer at BleacherReport.com, as well as a pro football focus fantasy football contributor. You can find my work by going to BleacherReport.com and searching my name. You can do that via Google as well. And if you use the TeamStream app, you can now add me as one of your favorite writers, and you can just click on writers, and all of my columns every week, every day will show up on your feed. And of course, Pro Football Focus is profootballfocus.com. And you can find me on Twitter at fball_Andrea, FBALL_Andrea.
And I'm Brian. And of course, I can be found at the end of this microphone on this podcast.
Indeed.
As well as on Twitter at BFAT65. That's at BFAT65.
Well, that wraps everything up for this week's episode of the F-Ball NFL Podcast. I'd like to thank everybody here for listening and joining us this week, as you do all the other weeks we blather on and on and on about this wonderful game we all love so much. Enjoy the scouting combine. I don't know, there's a couple hundred something dozen days till the NFL season starts, but we got a lot of stuff between now and then, so we'll be here for you here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast through all of it.
Oh, yeah.
So have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy the whatever you're doing with yourselves. And
the rest of the Olympics, maybe.
Maybe.
And you're watching that stuff.
And we'll be back next week.
Yes.
Peace.
Later.